This is a production from the Yak Podcasting Network. The home for your growing sonic map of local voices united in their commitment to the best in podcasting.
And now, a yak.
Yak!
Welcome, everybody. It is this week's edition of the Ticket City Podcast. It's the deal where all of the Orange Bloods guys get together to talk about the things going on in the world of Orange Bloods. It's been a busy week. It's been, thanks to Parker Braun and a little bit of, like, football stuff going on. There's been it's been an active week. And we've got the entire Orange Bloods gang joining us today. Alex, back from the Combine. Anwar, Jason, Dustin, me, Jeff Ketchum, we're all here. Lots of stuff to talk about. Fellas, all of us together really haven't discussed this yet for whatever reason, but Parker Braun is a Texas Longhorn, and it is a hell of a thing to see a guy that good jump into your program kind of out of thin air. The transfer rule, Anwar, has been incredibly good. The grad transfer thing wasn't always a big thing under previous coaches. Not that they didn't take any, but it feels like it's turned into a weapon of sorts for Tom Herman. And this may have been the biggest gun he's – maybe I should use a gun reference, but nobody listening to this podcast probably cares. But, you know, it's a big deal.
I'm tired of you, Jeff. This is what we're going in the war room. This is another thing I was going to put in the war room.
Oh, look, we had that.
How's this happen? How is this? This is like three straight weeks.
You got a spy cam on your house or something.
It's ridiculous.
Yeah, there's got to be something. Like, he's spying at us through Skype.
It is.
Cash, what is Anwar wearing right now?
Yeah. Nothing. Wait.
How do you know that?
No, I got my Under Armour.
Because I'm looking at you through the window.
No, seriously, now I know why people have their put tape over their webcams and stuff. Like, this is unreal. But, okay, so, Ketch, something I was going to have in the war room was about how Texas is using this to their advantage.
This is practice for the war room, Anwar. Talk it out a little bit. Because in the reality, only 10% of the listeners before the war, it's fine. I don't think you have to worry about this. This is a safe zone for you.
It's just ironic that this is like third straight week that your leadoff question to me was something I was going to put in a war room, which
what
is like.
What did you think comment. I was going to ask about?
I mean, you're going to beat Kendall Braun as a player. I don't know, something not like how they're using this as a grad. That's a specific thing.
Oh, it's just so okay. Why don't we do this? Let's eliminate the 30,000-foot view that I was asking you about, right? Let's just focus on Parker for a second, because really, that is the most important thing, is that, and you know what, Anwar, you be quiet for a second. Alex, I'm going to come to you. You're the offensive line guy. You have, before this kid announced his commitment to transfer to Texas, you've watched his film, you've written about him at length, you've gushed about him in a way that you usually only reserve for the likes of Casey Thompson. Give me some hyperbole. Give me some thoughts on where your head has been since that announcement.
Well, I always kind of, you know, behind the scenes, we talk on Slack and we talk behind the scenes. It always seemed like it was – I wouldn't have gone that in-depth and done all the games on him if I didn't think there was a pretty good chance he'd end up at Texas, just based on kind of reading the tea leaves and everything like that. But, boy, whenever I did watch the film, and I watched back a few of his full games from Georgia Tech as a junior, I said it in my column. He's an unbelievable prospect. You know, I just thinking about him off the top of my head. The first thing you think about are his feet. They're crisp. They're quick. Just a really good power step in the run game. Just what he can just really understand so well is just leverage. The way he can identify his leverage, even in open space at the second level on linebackers, just a guy that's always looking for work. And, you know, it's not like he's just one of these, you know, he's a little bit undersized, but it's not just like he's one of these smaller dudes that wins as a technician. And the way that kind of reminds me of the way that Jake McMillan was able to win that year when he was lined up next to Connor Williams. This guy's not a Jake McMillan. This guy's a guy who could actually, like, he has some real power to him. He gains his leverage on these three techniques via like reach blocks and just straight up power. So he's got not only the feed and the balance, the agility, the quickness, but he also has that pure power for being a little bit of an undersized guy. And boy, does he ever finish. I mean, it's one of the best motors that I've seen when I've evaluated a prospect. He was a all conference player in the ACC. He probably comes in to the, he immediately becomes the best offensive lineman that Texas has on his roster the minute he sets foot on campus, probably based on the way that he practices, I'm guessing the way he practices based on the way he plays makes him just an immense practice player, which is, we know, something that Tom Herman frequently gushes over. He talks about how important practice. I mean, you guys have heard it and heard it. I don't need to say how much he does it, but probably I wrote in my column. I believe I wrote this. I at least talked about it. Probably the best practice player Texas has seen since Malcolm Brown, the defensive tackle, who was just, that staff would just talk about how he just set such a tone in practice. The one thing that you worry about is that, let me just pull up his sheet here. All right, so he played 66 snaps versus Virginia Tech, and only three of those were pass blocking snaps. So Georgia Tech does not, we don't know about this guy's pass set really at all. But the way that he moves, the fact that he comes from an offensive line family, his dad's an offensive line coach, he's going to be fine as far as pass protection. I think that once he gets into the Texas strength and conditioning program this summer, he's, like we mentioned, a little bit undersized, but I think he can get up to close to 300 pounds. And when we think about the fact that Calvin Anderson played last year at like 280 pounds, you could even say from an NFL threshold standpoint, 300 pounds for a dude who's going to be playing guard or center, perfectly fine. Basically, I can't say enough about Parker Braun. He's been one of my favorite. I mean, between him and Jake Smith, this whole 2019 cycle has just been amazing to get to see players that I just think are just absolute studs that are going to be beasts. And, of course, it's different with a guy who's a grad transfer that, like, Braun is going to be clearly. He comes in with a different level of seasoning and experience, being an all-conference player previously than Jake Smith would have been. But he's a guy that has there's still – with both of them, there still is a little bit of, if not concern, just a little bit of a projection worry. With Braun, it's just the fact that he's going to kick ass in the run game. You know he's going to be a mauler. You know he's going to come in and be the best run-blocking player that Texas has on this roster. Absolutely no question about that. But there still is a little bit of worry about the pass protection. He has all the requisite traits, and he comes from the background and the pedigree to make me say that pass protection is not going to be a worry for him, especially since he's going to be playing a little bit protected inside of either one of those guard or center positions. He's already told Jason he's not going to be playing tackle, but I feel like he's going to be a quick study as far as the pass production technique. He's smart, so I'm not worried about him, being so bad against these stunts and these twists like Patrick Vahe was last year. So he's a huge upgrade, great player, huge get, as big as any that Texas has gotten over the course of this 2019 cycle.
Jason, one of the things that's been really interesting since his announcement is this discussion that's popped up about how open-minded he might be that the best – maybe the best path for him to the NFL might include a red shirt. And just that idea I give full credit to Alex on this one for the use of the word cockamamie. But
it is
your best offensive lineman who's a senior shows up after being a two-time all-conference player in another Power 5 conference. You get him. He immediately makes your team better. Immediately. This is a smart kid and, he seems to be very self-aware that, hey, I might want to play center. So maybe it would behoove me to take more time to learn that position. And maybe he's a perfectionist and so doesn't hate the idea of taking more time, to enrich his, ultimate upside. But with all due respect to attaboy, kid, nice self-awareness that you would even contemplate like there could be other plans and paths. This kid's playing right away. I've never lived in a world where the best offensive lineman in a program is a 20-something year old who says, no, I'm good. I'm actually going to take another year to get better. and you guys can see me in 2020. We're going to kick it down the road, kick that can down the road a little bit, and I'll just – and I know he would in theory have four games, but if your thought process is, well, we'll play him against Oklahoma. We can play him in a Big 12 championship game, and we can play him in a playoff game. Like, if you're thinking that, that dude needs to be on the field all the time. If you think you have Charles Jefferson from Fast Times from Ridgemont High, and it's like, well, we're going to fly this guy in on the weekends. He's our ringer. We're going to play him in the best games. Probably need him against LSU. Probably need him in the opener. Probably need him when you go on the road and you need to run the football. So, your thoughts on this story, because I've been amazed that of all the things that have been talked about since his announcement, this has been the most dominating side of the discussion, not the actual impact he's going to make this year and like what it suddenly does for Herb Hand in terms of availability and how he can move parts around. I've been like just stumped this week at this discussion.
Well, I've got several thoughts on it. The idea, and I talked to some guys about this yesterday, the idea, yeah, okay, what if they just play him four games and then redshirt him, and they play him against LSU and Oklahoma and maybe a Big 12 championship game and a bowl game or something. First off, offensive line, you need continuity. No coach is going to want to just plug a guy in sporadically for four games. Secondly, you're going to risk pissing off the rest of the offensive line because he's almost getting a little bit of favoritism. Who's, you know, imagine the guy who busts his butt for 12 weeks, but doesn't get to play in the four biggest games and say, oh, hey, you're playing well, but sorry, dude, we're going to put you on the bench so Parker can play in the four biggest games on the schedule. Man, you're going to ruffle a lot of feathers there, but I just don't see that being feasible. If you're going to play him four games and redshirt him, I think you either play him the first four games or play him the last four games, probably the last four games. but so a couple thoughts on this. First off, let me tell you kind of the way it's been explained to me what Parker Braun's thinking. I've said it all along. But he's a unique cat, just the way he and his family approached this whole recruiting stuff. They took the way I kind of described it to them. Yeah, that's a good way to say it. I mean, it was a long-term investment is the way they're looking at this decision. And by potentially redshirting, A, he gets a year with Yancey McKnight to – put some weight on his body, just kind of get stronger, do the things he needs to do to transform his body. They have tremendous amount of respect for Yancey McKnight. They feel like he could do a lot of things with Parker Braun's body if Parker took a redshirt year. B, he gets an extra year to learn under Herb Hand some of the things Alex talked about with his pass blocking and just, you know, things that he needs to kind of fine-tune, maybe get better at, learn Herb Hand's ways, get himself more marketable for the NFL. And thirdly, he gets 2 years to work towards his graduate degree instead of one. I mean, this is not just a football decision for Parker Braun. This was also an academic and a 50-year decision for him. So that's kind of what they're thinking. Now, how strongly are they thinking about it? I'll say this. That's the reason he committed to Texas last weekend, is because Texas could offer that opportunity to potentially redshirt. Florida, the other team he was strongly considering, couldn't offer it as much as Texas could, so that set Florida back. Ohio State could offer it to some degree because they took a graduate transfer from Rutgers, and they were selling Parker Braun on, hey, man, that kid will play this year. You can come up here and redshirt. But he's like, yeah, Ohio State's a long ways away. Is it really going to be any better than Texas? They're not going to be able to show me anything better than what Texas has shown him. So the redshirt thing, it played a huge role in his decision. And to the point, that's why he shut it down as quickly as he did. He wasn't anticipating committing when he came in, but that redshirt deal, the opportunity to redshirt, really pushed him over the edge to commit. Now, okay, that's Parker Braun's kind of perspective as it was described to me. Parker doesn't talk, so I'm having to go through other sourcing and talk to his family and things of that nature. He doesn't talk. He doesn't do social media. Like one guy said, he barely has a cell phone. Which I kind of like, by the way. My thinking, Catch, kind of like you, is he going to redshirt? I don't see any way that happens. Listen, Texas recruited him. You recruit graduate transfers because you have an immediate need this year. Texas has an immediate need at two of its guard spots. I mean, and Texas has big aspirations this year. This isn't a throwaway year. You know, this is the staff feels like by adding, and this is me speculating, I mean, but by adding Parker Braun, I got to feel like the staff thinks, hey, that suddenly makes us even a stronger candidate to win the Big 12. Who the hell knows? Maybe get in the college football playoff. They need and want Parker Braun this year. They're replaced. I mean, it's a perfect fit with them losing to guard prospects. What if Parker Braun redshirts this year and some of these young pups step in and play tremendously well? Well, then next year you're like, well, shit, man, those, we don't really need him as badly this year. You use him when you need him. They need him this year. And it, by playing him this year, it gives some of those younger guys another season to develop when, before, and they'll be truly be ready when they're called upon in 2020. I mean, nothing about redshirting him. I mean, I understand what Parker Braun, his thinking. It's kind of unique. I mean, most guys want to, you know, play their year and then start making their money in the NFL. But I can kind of understand his reasoning. I don't think I would do the redshirt thing like he's contemplating. But from the Texas coach's perspective, there's no way in hell, man. I'm thinking, hey, dude, if you're as good as we're expecting you to be, you can help us win the conference and who knows what beyond that. You're playing this year, and you're going to be the leader of that offensive line this year. And I will say this about Parker. Even though, you know, I don't think it's fair to say he wants to redshirt, but he's certainly open-minded to it and definitely agreeable to it, okay? He also knows, and it's been stated to me, the needs of the program come first. So ultimately, it'll be a mutual decision, but if Texas needs him to play this year to accomplish what the program can accomplish, he's going to play this year. And that's what I'm fully expecting to happen. But, you know, as you guys said, tremendous pickup, tremendous player. It was really fun for me covering his recruitment because, he is a different dude. Like I said, doesn't talk, doesn't do social media. And I was at the, just kind of the backstory, I was at the opening camp on Sunday up in Dallas. I had my phone on vibrate because I didn't want it going off while I'm talking to guys and videotaping guys and doing this, that, and the other up there. I didn't even notice that I had got a text from his dad saying, hey, Parker's a Longhorn with a picture. And I just happened to pull my phone out, and I look at it, and there's a text saying, Parker's a Longhorn. We're boarding the plane now. My phone will be off for 8 hours. And I'm thinking, oh, shit, because normally on that, I want to say, hey, are you okay with me reporting that? Are you okay with me putting that out there? Or, you know, or is the person just letting me know for my knowledge and they're going to announce it on their own terms? So I'm thinking, oh, my gosh, please let them not have taken off yet. Otherwise, I may be, like, sweating this for 8 hours. But I texted him back, and his dad's like, we are literally about to take off. And he goes, yes, put it out there. Boom. So I was able to go with it. But it was a pleasure covering the recruitment because, hey, Parker's not accessible, but those around him were incredibly accessible.
Nobody works the dad better than
Superman. Mom. Usually it's the mom. but yeah, he reached out to me, I mean, completely unsolicited. I mean, I knew he was visiting and all that, of course, but, I mean, he just texted me out of the blue with a picture and, hey, he committed to go with it. But I mean, very straightforward family and talking to him, and I just really respect the way they handled the recruiting process and just no nonsense, very businesslike, but that kind of carries over to the way he plays on the field, man. He's all about business and, you know, he just doesn't get caught up in the hoopla, in the spotlight and any of that kind of crap. So fun story to cover, great pickup for Texas. But as far as the redshirt deal, it's an interesting conversation. I mean, hell, there's a reason we're talking about it. It's just so unique. That's why it's interesting. But nothing about it to me makes a lot of sense from Texas's perspective, man. Get that guy on the field, make your team immediately better. A team that's already going to be really good, just got that much better by plugging him into the mix. You know, that's what you need to do and go out there and compete to the top of your ability. So I would expect him to be a day one starter. I would expect him to play the entire season in 2019.
Anybody else want to jump into the mix?
I'll just say it again, man. He's really good. Texas fans should be excited. There's no way he's going to redshirt. I mean,
I would love. You wrote about Herb Hand this week. I want to get you involved in the offensive line discussion. Just your thoughts on everything that we've talked about. Like, what's your reaction to what you've heard?
Well, yeah, as Jason explained the idea of the redshirt, but I mean, I'm like him and I'm like Alex. I just don't see any way it's going to happen. I'm sure it might seem like, you know, a possibility in his head right now, but the guy's simply too good. And you recruit graduate transfers really with the intention of these guys are going to be instant impact players. And I think he's got a chance to be the best player on offense, not named Sam Ehlinger. And maybe you could make a case that he's on Sam's level. I think it would be above Colin Johnson's level, but that's the kind of potential impact he could make. As for the offensive line in general, I just think it's funny. I thought back to right before the first national signing day when everybody was kind of losing their minds on Orange Bloods about Isaiah Hookfin sticking with Baylor potentially, and just the lack of offensive linemen in the class and kind of the panic about that position. And it's amazing what the position looks like now when you consider they do go get Hookfin, they hold on to Javonte Shepherd. They eventually go get Parker Braun. I mean, he wasn't even on the graduate transfer scene at that point in time. I don't think that was reported or announced until like late January. So they go out and get him, and he's arguably, I mean, he's going to end up being of non-quarterbacks. He might end up being the biggest name among graduate transfers. And then you go out and you get Willie Tyler, who I think we're seeing a trend with Herb Hand and really Texas. They seem to like betting on these high upside guys that don't quite have the extensive football background. And I think they bet on these guys because they see such a rapid improvement over the course of a year that you project a guy to continue to improve at that type of rate moving forward, because they don't have the extensive type of experience or, you know, technique work and all these things. But here you see this 6'7" big guy that's strong and athletic, and you're thinking, if he keeps improving like this down the road, this guy could be a monster. And I think it's similar to what, you know, why Moro Jomo was such a big get for Texas, a guy that really improved his junior year, from his junior year to his senior year. Christian Jones, a guy that we've talked about, limited football background. I think he had mostly a soccer background before his junior year in high school. He's a guy that's rapidly improved, another one of those big athletes. So I think you're kind of seeing that sort of trend with the big guys, that they're in a position now where they can take some smart bets on those guys. But really the job Herb Hand and that staff have done, I mean, I just feel like before the first national signing day, it's like, is Texas going to get a big offensive line class? And with the latest additions, not only has it done that, but they're really kicking some ass in the 2020 class as well. And it feels like that the long-term outlook for that position has really changed so much over the last 3 months. And I think you can make a case that in terms of talent and depth in the mix of kind of experience as well, that it's been as healthy as it's been in a long, long time. And, you know, that's, you know, it says a lot about the work Herb Hand and those guys have done, because they've really turned things around, and the future depth charts do look very promising.
Dustin, that's an interesting point I thought about that too, and I was actually going to mention it. It's funny that we've gone from every time Texas would get a commitment from anybody, they could get, you know, Jake Smith could commit and somebody would sarcastically say, can he play offensive line? And now it seems, I almost made the joke after the most recent commit, like, can he play corner, right? Because like,
can he play basketball?
Oh, wow.
Nice. Can he play, Alex?
You're ready to just move on.
Can he shoot?
That was muted, but that got a good laugh out loud for me. That was a good one, Alex.
Oh, Dustin's over there like cringing just because he knows it better than anybody. By the way, Dustin, Anwar and I discussed how in your most recent drop in dimes that you scaled back a little bit because, you know, it was an ass kicking on the hands of Texas Tech and like nobody bitched about it. And we were like, aha.
Oh, yeah, dude, that thing was done in 15 minutes. Like,
exactly. Is what, I mean, you should have been doing for a while.
Yeah, I mean, when there are games like that, I mean, it's super easy. Like, it's bam, 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 done, post that thing, read it once, and then I'm like, I'm going to hell to bed. Like, you guys have fun with this.
I think that was, like, still 500 words. Like, I think that even then, I was, like, Anwar was like, check out Dustin's article. He condensed it down some, and I looked at it. And I had to scroll down a little bit. And I was like, oh, it's still too much.
it was like 750 or 800 words. But I think I cranked that sucker out in like 15 minutes. Like, no problem.
Well, it was a game that could give you some quick thoughts. Anybody, like, on the Parker Braun discussion, and God, I am hesitant to ask this question, Anwar, in fear that you're going to tell me that I've asked another War Room subject. Any thoughts on – you're the person I want to ask more than anybody else on this because, you know, you might have heard whispers in the hallways or things like that in terms of, like, excitement level or just general reaction to – I mean, let me pull it back just a second. There's only – who are the first-team all-conference players on the roster? There's one. Colin Johnson wasn't first team All Big 12 last year.
Okay, I get what you're saying.
I'm saying from last
year.
Yeah, my bad. Like, just from last season, there are no first team All Big 12 returning players. Except, you know, did Caden Stearns make first team, maybe? Or was he just all.
Was he like newcomer of the year or something?
I don't know if he was first team. The general point is this is a roster that does not return outside of Sam Ehlinger. We could call Colin Johnson, I think, a big name because he's a skill position guy. But this isn't a team that returns a bunch of guys that were first-team all-conference level players a year ago. So Parker Braun shows up on campus, and outside of potentially a conversation with him versus Sam Ehlinger, I think as was just noted previously, he might be walking on to the camp. Forget about his NFL upside for a second. He may be the best player in the program the moment that he shows up.
Wasn't Zach Sackleford a first team all conference or no. first or
no, but he was elected by the media in the preseason is that in those preseason polls I've done the studies.
He was the second all Big 12 team. That's a second team. He made a few.
He was even the best player on that line though. So what
I just don't want, you know, someone with Shackleford's parents like, what about us? Or you know, someone on the board saying, you forgot Shackleford or something.
I feel like nobody, I wrote about this the other day that there were no other first team selections coming back and like nobody stepped up to me and said I was wrong. And believe me, if I was wrong, there have been 40 of them.
Ain't that a truth?
So it have been the only thing from my column that people were talking about was like, catch you wrong. Zach Shackleford made first team All Big 12 by Phil Steele. You don't know what you're talking about.
So. Yeah, I think the what's interesting about this catch is that you know you kind of alluded to it a little bit before, and I can just tell you like, you know, I talked to some people this week, and kind of one of the things that they're a little bit proud of, and I won't say a little bit, but feeling pretty good about is their ability to add in impactful type of grad transfers. You know, they look back and. Feel pretty good that they thought that was his name Kendall Moore, the kid from Syracuse, the tight end. If I remember his name correctly, that towards the end of that season, when he kind of got more comfortable, they felt like he was able to make some plays. Felt he was good in the pass protection and run blocking. They were able to add in Trey Watson and Calvin Anderson. Both guys were starters and, you know, leaders essentially in both their respective rooms. And now you're talking about adding in this offensive lineman who, you know, like we're talking about all intents and purposes should be a starter and could be, you know, the best offensive lineman of the group. So what I sense is people feeling pretty good about their ability to attract, you know, grad transfers. I thought one thing that Jason pointed out was really interesting from his story was Parker talking about working with Yancey McKnight. And so you have like that appeal of, you know, the Yancey McKnight and what Yancey McKnight is being able to do and him being part of that recruiting process and the building of the bodies and the guys being intrigued by that. So just Texas's ability, it's almost like, you know, I felt like grad transfer was just a bonus or a throwaway and now it's kind of becoming like a key component as far as their recruiting, especially to fill necessary holes, is finding guys. And what they feel, Ketch, is really important is that when grad transfers can come here and visit, and they can appoint to Kendall Moore, but more importantly, now they can point to a Trey Watson and can point to Calvin Anderson and say, hey, you're not going to come here and get lost in the shuffle. This is what's going to happen when you come here, and this is how we treat our grad transfers. It becomes a little bit more of an appealing recruiting aspect. So that's what the main thing, main takeaway, the main thing I would just say is everyone in the building feeling really good about how they're able to recruit from the grad transfer department.
I think that's a great point. And I have to admit, every time a season ends and the Longhorns, the last couple of years, they have needs. And specifically, I'm just thinking about this year where it's like, you know, we could use this, we could use that. And hey, Ketch, are there any grad, like how buy or sell, you think Texas gets at least two grad transfers? And I kind of shrug my shoulders because I instinctively think that that's a needle in the haystack thing, that it's a matter of circumstances. And sometimes you're going to get a guy, but in most years you won't. And in recent years, Texas hasn't been that desirable of a place to play. So why would a guy choose Texas if he has options? And now I feel like, no, I have to – every year I think we were learning that if there is a grad transfer that's available, or two, or three, or four, or five, Texas is going to know about them. They will make a concerted effort to go get them. They will be aggressive in a way that I don't know previous staffs were. And they've had an amazing amount of success, I think. Like, it's not – the volume, we're talking about three, four guys, five guys, that's a lot. Like, that is more than most teams, certainly. I think if we were to compare grad transfers across the Big 12, I'm guessing the majority of the programs don't have more than one or two, and that Texas is, like, pulling them in at those numbers. I think it shows a real aggression by the staff. And to follow that point up, Anwar, I think the staff has to feel amazing right now about the job that they're doing. They are doing a great job of recruiting grad transfers, which is a weird little niche. Like, I don't even know. I've never heard of a coaching staff really doing that. And they seem to have a bit of a hot streak going. And they are killing it in recruiting. They just landed a top five class. They switched over Brew McCoy when all logic and history showed that ain't happening. And that happened. They beat Georgia in the bowl game. They played for a Big 12 championship. A year ago, this was a staff I think that could easily have questioned itself. It was Tim Beck's a disaster, and they got to move. They got to go get a new offensive line coach, and they still don't have this, and they still don't have that. And 12 months later, they checked a lot of boxes in those 12 months. And, you know, I think that the question now is ultimately how far can they continue to ride this momentum? But this staff has it. And if I'm Tom Herman and I'm going to work every single day, I'm feeling really good about the crew that I have. Nitpicks that fans might have withstanding, they've done a hell of a lot of really great things in the last few months. And I would imagine that there is an extra bounce in each of those, everybody in that building step right now.
I mean, you got to think so. I mean, you know, everyone's got to be feeling good about those things that they're doing. And it kind of just kind of harkens back for me, Ketch, when I, you know, obviously reported several weeks ago that, you know, Tom Herman was going to keep his guys on one-year deals. And the main motivation for that is to make sure that nobody becomes complacent, make sure that everyone still has kind of fire in them. And there was, like, mixed reactions, you know, to that from some folks. But I think you can also see that as he orchestrates it and how he organizes it, he is finding a way to make sure that guys aren't, you know, getting lazy or lax or anything like that. It's not to say these guys would, but to your point, Ketch, when all these guys were hired, there were question marks. And the biggest question mark was, who's their ace recruiter? I mean, that was the question that you guys asked. Who was their Tim Brewster? And Tim Brewster was a guy that everyone talked about almost every year until he went to A&M, that they needed this type of guy in order to have that impact. And what you're able to see is that, you know, how guys are developing as far as recruiters are concerned. You can see they're becoming good. Obviously, Brian Carrington does a lot of things behind the scenes too. And then you've seen them as coaches kind of grow and develop and kind of find their own little niches and be able to get the most out of their sides of the ball. So, like, overall, If you just look at that staff, you just do a staff evaluation, you know, you got to be feeling pretty good about what they're able to do as an overhaul, you know, comprehensive unit.
Jason, it's funny. It wasn't that long ago when Anwar reported first, by the way, and as always, spot on, Tom Herman had no interest in – he was going to bring his entire staff back. There was, I think, still some thought that go get a recruiter that can beef up the Metroplex, and maybe not all the guys are A-plus guys. Maybe Oscar Giles isn't – you know what I mean? Like you go through – all these things, and at the end of the day, it's a staff that he didn't change. He had some questions about it, and I don't know that you can question Tom Herman's decision making right now. Like I think he's earning some benefit of the doubt, and it's been a while since God, you know, you go back to the heyday of. Mack Brown, where you would say legitimately, like, hey, things in almost every area are rocking and rolling, and so on some level we've got to, let's remember this, the day Texas loses a recruit and everybody loses their shit, I think there's got to be like a general, Tom Herman and the staff, I think, have earned a little bit of benefit of the doubt. They've legitimately earned it. And I'm curious to see, like, if that matters in the grand scheme of the way we interact on a message board or how fans perceive things. Just seems like a long time since I've lived in a world where I can say, I think Herman's earned the benefit of the doubt.
Well, I think after the last couple of recruiting cycles, I think you kind of have to give him the benefit of the doubt, don't you, after the way they
closed. But I mean it. Everything. I mean, Tom Herman says, I don't want to change anybody on my staff.
Yeah, okay. Yeah.
I don't need this. I don't need that. This is what I want, and this is what I have. I think that we have to defer to him on some level because he's, you know, it's not that he's mistake-proof because he has made mistakes, but he sure has made a lot of good ones, and he seems to learn from his mistakes, which makes me inclined to give him some benefit of the doubt.
You know, it's funny. I did it was Monday this week. I did a radio show here in Austin with Chad Hastings and Kevin Dunn. I just talked to them for a little bit. And we kind of talked about that same subject. They asked me, I said, I'm sure if I really tried to poke around, I could find something to be critical of with Tom Herman, but you'd really have to try, man. I mean, pretty much every button he seems to push has worked, including recruiting and just, you know, obviously the play on the field. I mean, listen, there's always times you can critique play on the field and coaching calls and things of that nature, but you know, from upgrades in facilities and just winning over high school coaches and recruiting, and I mean, everything seems to be trending in the right direction. And from a recruiting perspective, yeah, I'll give him the benefit of the doubt. Overall, yeah, if Tom Herman makes a decision, I'm thinking, well, you know, I may not necessarily completely agree with him, but he knows a hell of a lot better than I do. And his track record so far in Austin has been pretty damn good with every decision he's made. So, you know, it like you said, Kat, so it's kind of I'm having to retrain my brain a little bit because it's been a long time since we've been in a position where we can comfortably feel like, okay, hey, man, this dude knows what he's doing. It's going to be the right call. Just have confidence in what he's doing is going to be the right call. It's been a while since we've had that. That kind of line of thinking as journalists covering this program and frankly for the fans as well. So it's a fun time to be covering the program. You know, it's not always going to be rainbow and sunshine. I mean, and roses, there'll be.
No, they lose to LSU.
Well, exactly. everything goes back to square one if that happens. But, you know, the things he's done from support staff members and recruiting, and I mean, I'm talking about winning over parents. I mean, I talked to a parent last night, and I'll have an update on Chad Lindbergh in the war room. I mean, you know, this staff is doing, you know, and I'm mostly focused on recruiting, of course, but in winning over kids and parents and Zachary Evans. You know, I talked to his brother a couple weeks ago down at the Rivals camp, and he just couldn't say enough about the Texas coaching staff, including Brian Carrington. He's really close with Carrington, but, you know, I mean, just everything, every button Herman is pushing, certainly of late, seems to be working. So yeah, I think he does, like you said, he deserves benefit of the doubt. But frankly, I don't even have any doubts. I mean, I can't even think of anything lately where I thought, okay, I'm not sure I agree with that. You know, I mean, when he does make a decision that I kind of scratch my head about, I'll give him the benefit of the doubt. But lately, I don't even know what you could even doubt him about. Everything he's done has been a home run, it feels like.
Anwar, I have an interesting question, but I want to throw this out to Alex. I want to throw it out to Jason. I want to throw it out to Dustin because he's back. And nobody even knew he was gone. He's stealth like that. And this is an interesting rabbit hole to go down, so apologies for putting anybody and everybody on the spot. Who do we think is potentially the first guy from this staff of, you know, it is a group that has analysts now that everybody, I think, would covet, you know, the Brian Carringtons of the world, the Yancey McKnights of the world. He's got a coaching staff in Todd Orlando. How long do we think this gang of everybody, the entire gang, how long do we think this gang of staff stays together before there's a departure that could change, you know, the chemistry or I don't know, like any thoughts on that at all? Like it's kind of an out of right field question, but this does seem to be a group that is, they're all on 1 year deals for the most part, but this seems to be a group that Herman's very comfortable with. He seems to have a lot of guys in different areas that, you know, Yancey McKnight and Brian Carrington and Todd Orlando and, you know, Drew Merringer. Like, there's a lot of guys that are doing good work. Who is the first, do we think that, is it Todd, is it as easy as at some point Todd Orlando will get a job?
I don't know if it's that easy. I mean, if you're looking for a specific timeline, I think this will probably be the last season the whole gang's together, just because what happens when programs start having a lot of success and have continued success. And if Texas has the season that I think they're going to have and many others think they're going to have, people are going to come around and want their coaches and offer some of those coaches upgrades. And especially if they're coaches that have proven to be able to go get good players. So, you know, if Texas has the season many people are thinking, I think that it's just, you know, it's the nature of college football. People are going to go try to hire some of those guys, whoever it is. So I don't know if it's necessarily as easy as Orlando, because part of me thinks that he's got such a great gig and such familiarity and such freedom and such comfort with what's going on that he can kind of wait for that job that he wants. I'm not saying he's going to wait and, you know, go take a top job somewhere. Like, you know, he's not going to become, for example, I don't know, Arizona's head coach next season or something like that, but he can, if he wants to, just wait for that opportunity that he really, really wants, that he feels like he can have success with, because he is making a ton of money as a defensive coordinator at Texas. So I don't know if it's as simple as saying he's going to go, but I would just be surprised if we get to the 2020 season and everybody is back, because I just think Texas is going to have a good season. And when that happens, back-to-back good seasons, you're getting a bunch of top recruits, people are going to go try to hire some of those guys and offer some of those guys upgrades and increased opportunities and roles at somewhere else.
I don't have any information, so this is just my guess and my
yes.
gut. So if I had to put money on someone being gone, I would probably put money on Drew Merringer being out after this year. I would think that his reputation as a recruiter and what he's been able to do from a recruiting standpoint, I think he's also a guy that, you know, as a former OC, you're talking about a guy who has been able to develop talent. You've seen Devin Duvernay improve. You've seen Colin Johnson improve. You saw little Jordan Humphrey improve. I think he's a guy that got some sniffs at some positions last year, but when you couple what he's been able to do from a coaching standpoint, recruiting standpoint, and then of course, you know, being the eyes in the sky, to help Tom Herman, him and Tim Beck in the booth, as far as calling plays is concerned. If there was like a dark horse and I probably make some good money on a bet, I would probably put some money on Merringer.
Interesting call there. That's, and I think that makes a lot of sense. Anybody else want to throw a name out there?
I don't have a specific name, but that makes what Omar said makes perfect sense. I mean, you're talking about a young guy that's
developed position, and he gets guys. I mean, look at what he's done the last couple of recruiting classes. That's the sort of thing that gets a lot of people's attention as it relates to something like an offensive coordinator job or something else.
Yeah, I agree with Anwar. I mean, and he's got the offensive coordinator, you know, experience already. You know, rivals National Recruiter of the Year. He can wear that badge into an interview. He would make the most sense. I had someone ask me yesterday, is Herb Hand a potential head coaching candidate? Because, I mean, recruiting and on the field, he's done as well as any coach on the staff. But I don't know. I've never talked to Herb Hand. But to me, so those offensive line guys usually want to stay. They're just kind of laser focused on what they do as offensive line guys. So he would surprise me. You know, Jason Washington's always a guy I would keep an eye on, another guy who's young and just energetic and just super easy to talk to and relate to and recruits well. But I think, yeah, I agree with Omar. I think Behringer would be the – if I had to pick one, I think he would be the most likely.
And one thing I'll just go back to, Ketch, one thing I've quoted this before since I've been here, but I just always remember something that Tony Dungy had told me, and I use this – in reverse way, as they're talking about Charlie's staff, but it's probably more of a positive way to talk about this staff. He always told me that the signs of a healthy staff is when assistants are being viewed or talked about for coordinator positions, and coordinators are being viewed or talked about for head coaching positions. And you have a staff where you can start getting that chatter where people are looking to, you know, getting interviewed to move up and get potential things. They may not have received them, but going back to what a Hall of Fame coach told me, it really shows that Tom Herman does have a healthy staff.
One final thing, and then we'll move on. Someone asked me, I can't remember if it was in a buy or sell question or if I was just in a discussion with somebody on the message boards, but somebody asked me if I thought that Brian Carrington could make $1 million a year in college football, which is – silly on the surface, because it wasn't that long ago that there was an article that detailed, like, this dude's doing a lot of work and he's actually not making a ton of money. And I think that that's been addressed. But, you know, I think if we're talking about dollar per pound, like, if he had a war number or something like that, I think that he would rate very high in, like, value per dollar and his overall effectiveness as an employee. And I just wonder if we're ever going to reach a moment. Like, if I was Nick Saban and I was watching this guy and I felt like, you know what, I've got my ass kicked on a couple. I'm Alabama and it's not quite all number one emphatic recruiting classes. So I want to liven things up. Let me go to the Board of Regents in Alabama. Hey, I want to hire this guy, and I want to pay him $500,000 a year. And what's he going to do? I don't know. We'll create a title. What he's going to do is invigorate our recruiting to an entirely new level. Are you cool? You guys cool with me creating a position and giving this guy $500,000 a year because I think he's among the best in college football? There's nobody else like him. Like, I wonder if there will be a point where somebody approaches Brian Carrington and offers him the moon and says, we've created this position for you, because I think it would be groundbreaking in terms of magnitude, but I think he's worth that. If someone were to ask me what I think Brian Carrington is worth per year to the University of Texas, well, if we place value on recruits and we were to say in a sport that generates $1 billion over the course of, you know, every couple of years or more than that, if you include like all of the programs together, I would say that Brian Carrington's value is definitely greater than $1 million per year in terms of what he provides to the program, even if you can't completely quantify it. I don't know. Like, does anybody ever anticipate that could happen? Or
yes,
you do?
Oh, absolutely. He is. I think we'll look back in years from now and we're going to say Brian Carrington totally reshaped what a director of recruiting is supposed to do and what their expectations are. Because, Ketch, if you are a university and you're looking at what Brian Carrington is doing at the director as a director of recruiting, you're looking at your director of recruiting and saying, hey, why are you not doing that?
Why don't you have something that's somewhat catchy that everyone wants to be involved with? He's got a shush. Well, what do you have? Like, it is because he is outperforming his position and by leaps and bounds. It would be like you hiring somebody to be on staff and they broke every single story and that was there, you know, but you were paying him like, you know, $25,000, you're paying him $15,000, right? Or, you know, $10,000. And he broke every single story that's out there and everyone's high-fiving and Tom Herman's retweeting him. And you're like, this guy's getting paid. You look at Jason and I, you're like, dude, you guys are out, you know? So, who wouldn't want to go and pistol, you know, money with that guy? I almost said pistol with. Who wouldn't want to go money with that guy? And then I'm sure some other people would like to pistol with him. But, you would have the value that he brings to Texas for his position. I saw something a couple of weeks ago. I put in my Sunday pulpit where he was invited to speak at a conference. It is what he's doing is so groundbreaking. It's just a matter of time. You know, Oregon sniffed around at him. You know, obviously that didn't work out. But someone at some point is going to say, you know what? Can't beat him, join him. And we need that guy. It is not, if people think that, okay, well, you could just find another one like that, or guys like this are so unique who he's young, right? He's innovative. He knows how to connect with the players on a level that's real. He connects with the parents. Jason can attest to this. And I just can't think of any, last thing I'll say, and then shut up. I can't think of one other kid in the country that I've seen that is committed to a program because of that program's director of recruiting.
No, it's Anwar. I've been doing this for a long time. Jason, too, man. But, you know, I've been covering recruiting since 1995 on a professional level, ranking recruits and really in depth since 97. Never seen anything like it. In terms of impact, it reminds me of what Brewster used to do as a staff member back when he was in his heyday, where it felt like every kid mentioned him. And it felt like every kid mentioned how impactful he was and that he could talk the talk with the young guys. And they thought of him as a bit of a brother figure. I've never seen it from a guy in that position. I have nobody else in almost 25 years of being on this beat at any school in the country that I can compare him to and say, he's like that dude that used to coach in Alabama but wasn't actually a coach. He's like that guy that was, you know, leading recruiting back. And there's just nobody. He is lightning in a bottle. And I just wonder at what point somebody decides he's worth way more than anybody has ever paid a guy at that position. And I don't know, say that Bob Stoops decided he wanted to get back into coaching. And Bob Stoops got the USC job just so that I could establish a big name with a big school, and Bob Stoops was like, we need a Brian Carrington. I don't know anybody else who can be the Brian Carrington. I value that as much as I value my strength coach and or any of my coordinators, so I'm going to go after him and offer him a deal that matches mine in length. So let's say maybe I'll give him a four-year deal, and I'm going to have the school approve $2 million over 4 years. Like, that's pretty life-changing, and I'm just curious if Texas would be prepared at that point to say, we'll match it, we'll do anything to keep him. He's the most interesting – I bring it all – he's just the most interesting guy on this staff for me. And I don't know if we – as much as we talk about him, Jason, I don't know if we fully, like, talk about in totality, like, how unique – how much of a unicorn he has become, and – it's quite an amazing thing to kind of watch in action.
Well, his name came up, you know, I talked to a bunch of recruits last week at the opening camp, and his name came up with a couple of those dudes. You know, I always ask, oh, which coaches are recruiting you the hardest? Oh, it's, Oscar Giles and BC, Brian Carrington. Oh. I mean, I always say like the coaches get most of the credits, you know, Drew Maringer, recruiter of the year, and Herb Hand, for his offensive line recruiting. The support staff that Tom Herman has, and it's not just Carrington. I mean, Derek Chang and Jake Longy's really good. There's a couple others. I'm blanking on his name. There's a young guy that's I think he's kind of carrying his assistant. I mean, those guys do a tremendous, tremendous job, and it makes the coaches' jobs just a lot easier to close the deal. But, you know, Carrington in particular, man, you know, as you guys are talking about this, I'm thinking there really isn't anybody else like him. And to the point, remember a couple weeks ago when it was the Oklahoma version of Brian Carrington tried to talk some smack on Twitter?
Yes.
And I don't even know, even now, I don't even know that guy, who that guy's name. So, you know, it's like, I mean, no, there is nobody like Brian Carrington. He's had other offers. He's going to continue to have other offers. At some point, you know, if somebody comes with a big money offer, then it's going to get interesting. What does Texas do? You know, I mean, surely Tom Herman understands and sees Carrington's value. You know, how high would Texas go with the money? How happy is Carrington? He's a young dude, just living in Austin. It's got to be pretty great for a guy like him. So, you know, you mentioned a guy like Nick Saban. Well, if I'm Brian Carrington, I'm thinking, okay, man, listen, $1 million, I get it. But, you know, he's also working for Tom Herman, a young coach. You know, he could work with Herman for the next 15, 20 years if he wants, and then theoretically retire. I mean, money talks, I get it. But I think he's happy I know he's happy in Austin. I think he and Herman have a good thing going. They have a good relationship. Like I said, he's a young dude living in Austin and really enjoying it. He's really found his niche, man. I think it's gonna be tough for someone to pry Brian Carrington away, but
not at $500,000.
Well, exactly. Money talks. I say that with the assumption that Texas would. You know, at least come close to matching any other offer he gets. Okay. You know, if Texas is willing to step up to the plate financially, I think Brian Carrington's here for the long haul. If Texas says, all right, sorry, dude, we can't, you know, we're going to keep you at the level you're at and someone else offers him $500K. Yeah. Then he'll go live wherever the hell he needs to live for that price. But, you know, just a tremendous job. I talk to the recruits, and this is just kind of a nutshell, the way it's been described to me is, he's young enough where he really relates to the recruits. They tell me, I mean, recruits all tell me, you know, Mookie Cooper said it when he committed. He said, he's almost like a brother. They view him like a brother, not as a coach that, you know, a coach is still your superior. You got to kind of watch what you say around him. They can talk to Brian Carrington about anything they want to talk to. They feel comfortable talking to him. But you know what? He's also old enough. And I don't know how old he is, honestly. I don't know what his actual age is. But he's old enough and respected enough that parents still respect him enough almost as a father figure for their kids. But the coaches look at him as a brother. So he's kind of in that fine line there. I mean, it works tremendously well for him, and he uses it to his advantage just very well, and it's been great for Texas.
I could see a guy like Manny Diaz. You know what I mean? I'm trying to think about guys in my head that might – be aggressive in trying to create that kind of thing.
Well, and Manny's a young dude too. I mean, Manny has some Brian Carrington. I mean, Manny's a head coach, of course, but personality wise, he and Carrington have some. I could see Manny Diaz being really good in a Brian Carrington role. I mean, he's not going to go back to that role, obviously, with the money he's making in Miami, but those two are pretty similar. That would make a lot of sense, dude. I could see those two working well together. And Manny's a forward thinking young coach. I mean, as is Tom Herman, but yeah, sorry to step on your conversation there, Cash. That's a really good call.
Did we talk about Manny Diaz last week? And I can't remember who I had that conversation with about what he did, Dustin, with the with the coach. It was like a coaching convention in Florida, and I think it was either the Florida or the Florida State coaches were getting ready to have their breakout sessions.
Yeah, it was the Florida State coaches.
It was a Florida State like breakout session where they were giving pitches to coaches, and right at the time that they were getting ready to have their breakout session with the high school coaches, Manny Diaz and his Miami staff threw like a kegger. Like, they basically said free beer, and everybody ran into the Miami party to drink free beer because, Jason, you know as well as anybody, what high school coach doesn't want to slam a few free beers?
Yeah. Or journalist.
or journalist. And he totally, like, that was the talk of the day, the next day. Actually, Dustin, I want your reaction to that because You're a Florida State guy. That's your heart. That's your soul. I thought that was freaking funny.
You better hope he wins. That's all I gotta say.
Yeah.
You better hope he wins.
Listen to that disdain in the Florida State side of McComas.
That's fine. Do all those antics. You gotta win games.
You know, Willie Taggart better win some games, too.
Well, if he does it, I know he'll get fired, so that's okay.
Hey, let's real quick, basketball. Because is there anything else? Jason, anything recruiting we definitely want to jump into real quick? I do want to go – there are two things that Dustin deserves a little bit of floor space with, and I do want to get to Alex on the combine. So can we – are we good in a position to transition a little bit?
We didn't talk about Billy Tyler, but I've covered him in depth, the new offensive line commit, JUCO offensive line commit. But if you're listening to this, you're probably on Orange Blood, so we've covered him thoroughly. You can check out all the thoughts on Orange Blood.
Actually, Alex, I want to come to you. Dustin, be prepared. We're going to do basketball and baseball next. The itinerary for the rest of the show will be let's get some combine stuff from Alex. Let's go to you for basketball and baseball, and then we'll do parting shots just – we're all on the same page. Alex, you're back. Did you get the shrimp cocktail that you wanted in Indianapolis?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. First night there, definitely. I got shrimp cocktail, I think. I was there four nights. I think I got shrimp cocktail. Only two. And I'm sorry if you guys hear my son's turned into a chatterbox. And he was just, this morning, he just did not want to go to bed during the podcast. He was shrieking in his room for like an hour. I couldn't stand it anymore. So I'm here in the living room with him. He's trying to get me to read his furry friends book.
Fair enough. Give us some combine thoughts. I mean, now that it's been a couple of days, what stands out the most? Like, what have you, with a little bit of perspective and time to soak it all in, what's running through your head the most?
Well, little Jordan Humphrey, of course, with the disaster. I mean, it was the 4.75 on the 40 was the official time, but it was who would have? I mean, I said that I think he could come in maybe at 4.65, right? I mean, is that about what you guys sort of thought, just watching his on-field speed, maybe a 4.65? I did never think he was going to be anything where he was going to be a 4.5 runner, like he said at his combine interview. But, boy, I mean, testing it. Did you guys think that he would be that slow?
No, that surprised me. I would have thought 4.6 range as well.
Yeah. And so, I mean, maybe mid 4.6 is what I thought. And that just wasn't, you know, that wasn't what came to fruition. I mean, I was inside Lucas Oil for his wide receiver quarterback session. I've been to each one of those for the last 9 years. I can't remember a guy that actually looks slower on those go routes, on the post corner fade route, and on the over the shoulder route. Like, these quarterbacks were just overthrowing him badly because they were just he just couldn't get underneath those balls. So really, really bad combine for little Jordan Humphrey. People snare him now, saying he should have come back. And I was like, what? Come back for what? He's, you know, his speed is his speed. It's not going to change, right? So I don't think that he would have been able to improve on that 4.75 number. And if we're being completely honest, it might be hard to improve production-wise with all the new talent kind of coming in, Colin Johnson still being here in town, et cetera. So I don't necessarily think it was a bad idea for him to leave, I guess, if he's just looking at it from a pure NFL kind of projection standpoint. If he's looking at it from a kind of a life standpoint, you know, I asked him there in his interview if he was going to graduate. He said that's not even a question. That's not even negotiable. I plan on graduating. But I think the only upside coming back would be to actually get that degree, which could come in handy because I'm not sure, you know, he's got to prove a way that he can win at the NFL level with that sort of that kind of speed that you know, that's past the threshold where he's just a lot of teams will just kind of take him off the board. Right. So, you know, that definitely stands out also just from his overall athleticism on the whole entire week. Only a 28th percentile wide receiver athlete at the NFL level across all his drills. So it was definitely definitely bad for him. You know, Chris Boyd was about like I thought he was going to be. I think that Chris Boyd tested well and Indy and looks great in Indy because that's what Chris Boyd does. He looks really good whenever there's not a wide receiver lined up across from him. You know, 85th, 86th percentile athlete on most bench reps of anybody else, ran fast. Devontae Davis also did really well as far as he was like a 74th percentile athlete, which I certainly wasn't expecting, but we were expecting the big vertical. I mean, he had a 33-inch vertical, I remember, just coming out of high school. So we knew he was going to test fairly explosively. And then, of course, Gary Johnson, I talked about him, that I thought that he might be able to even break Shaquem Griffin's record in the 40-yard dash at 4.38 that he was able to set last year, just because we know that he ran that 10.65 back in JUCO, I guess. And that generally that 10.6-ish area, 10.65, right around there, equals out to about a 4.440 in some of these kind of sort of looser studies and research people have done on this. So eyeballing it, you figure he'd be right in there. He didn't quite get there. He ran a 4.42, but still really fast. And I've seen him referenced by a bunch of these different you know, media sites and different, you know, articles and stuff as one of the, you know, top 10 players that improved their stock at the combine. And that was to be expected coming in. I think with Charles Omenihu, it was, you know, with him, it was the, you know, I mean, for him running a sub-five second 40, I feel like he's plenty good enough. He ran a 4.92. These numbers I'm trying to remember off the top of my head. I don't remember his exact vertical, but I think it was like 36 inches. I'd have to look that up and double check it. But I remember his vertical was whatever it was. I do know it was 91st percentile among defensive linemen and edge players at the NFL level. So not only did he come in, we already knew about the arm length, which was going to be the biggest measurement there in Indy anyway, but it wasn't such a big surprise to everybody because we already got that 36-inch measurement from the National Scouting weigh-in at the Combine. But, you know, that's going to be his greatest strength at the NFL level is just his ability to outlink guys. And he should be able to outlink anybody because this is you have to go back to 2013 to find anybody else who has 36-inch arms, and that was DJ Fluker. So even these offensive linemen he's going to be going up against at the NFL level, he's going to have longer arms than even those guys. I think that he tested explosively enough. And most importantly, man, you can just tell at his podium appearance and from the way he dealt with the media, he's just been prepared so well for these interviews. I think the interviews with teams probably went really, really well. And Charles continues to sort of take his way up. I see absolutely zero way now that he gets out of the second round. And I think I think the teams like him enough and see enough tools in him to where you'd probably be wise to put him inside the top 50 if you were making a big board.
What about Lil Jordan? I mean, ultimately, what area of this draft has he put himself in? And how much can a good pro day, you know, kind of get him back on track to, you know, we were talking about him as a third or fourth round pick, I think, when he declared. And it doesn't feel like 4.75 guys go in the third or fourth round very often.
No, and you know, here's the thing: he's going to improve at the pro day, just because, like, I'll get my time, the scouts will get their times, and these are hand times. They're going to be, you know, they're going to be, five hundredths of a second faster, just by the fact of the matter that that's the way that your eye, you know, that's like your ocular acuity. It's like it's. Your eye can't get the signal to your hand. It's just like human. It's just, you know, the human factor that goes into it. So he's going to improve, and his agent's probably going to tell people that the scouts. I mean, I can already see it. What, you know, kind of reminds me a little bit about Kendall Wright whenever he had his just disastrous combine 40, like a 4, and that was a disaster. It was only a 4.6 something, but he came back to Baylor and he had a legitimate improvement. Down to truly, you know, what I measured it is as like I had him like a 4.42, but the scouts, you know, they're at that Baylor pro day. I guess I was back. Kendall Wright, since we're going back there, but I remember that, you know, he improved by 0.2 of like what they consider basically a legit 0.2 of a second, even if you adjust, you know, a few hundredths of a second just due to the hand timing. I don't think that that's going to happen with Lil Jordan Humphrey, because I don't necessarily think that he got off any sort of really bad start or did anything, you know, completely egregious with his form in the run. I just think he's a little bit slow. I think probably if he'll get time to pro day, So he'll work on it. He'll probably pick up a few tips, and I think he'll get a time to the pro day somewhere in the 4.6s range, 4.6s, probably high 4.6s, maybe mid 4.6s. And his agent should tell everybody is that he was timed as low as 4.59, just so he could get a 4.5 in there somewhere. And I think that that's going to be the way that thing all turns out. And I'm not sure how much it's going to help in the eyes of the scouts if he only improves. I mean, man, coming in there running a 4.75, I don't think that little Jordan Humphrey is that slow. And so if he came and he ran a 4.75, what is this? To me, I think these scouts will think it says a little bit of something about his lack of preparation for this. I mean, this was not good for him to come in and only be a 28th percentile athlete when he's shown a lot more athleticism than that on the football field. He's certainly been a better wide receiver than you would consider a 28th percentile athlete to be. So, at this point, you ask where he's going to be, where he slots in. I mean, he's going to be picked in day three. If he gets picked, there's definitely a shot, man, after that.
If he gets picked.
Yeah. I mean, well, there's a
shot. You think he could fall into the land of undrafted?
Yes. Tuna Ford was the defensive lineman of the year for the Big 12 last year. We didn't think there was any chance he could go undrafted after the week he put up at the Senior Bowl, all the rest of it. But he went undrafted and went on a great rookie year for the Seattle Seahawks. I don't think it's out of the question that Jordan Humphrey could go undrafted, and I think I think he will get drafted. If I had to put money on it, I put money on the fact that he does get drafted. But I think it will definitely be on the third day, somewhere probably fifth, sixth, seventh round.
All right, mute your microphone for a second.
Trust me, I'm going to.
Fellas, just anybody want to jump in? Anybody got anything on the draft? Because the combine? Because I was the little Jordan Humphrey 40 time. With all due respect to the Gary Johnson numbers and what some of the guys really helped themselves. I hate that we focus on the negative here, but little Jordan's 40 time was a stop me in my tracks kind of deal. Like I saw that and I legitimately did a double take and wondered if the person messed up a number.
Well, it was like that with him, and it was like that with Elijah Holyfield. Those were the two stories.
Yes, right.
And, I mean, it's like those were the two big stories, the big flops of the whole week.
Oh, wow, that's rough, man. And your column on Sunday talked about, you can respect a guy's decision to go pro, but sometimes it's very hard to watch unfold. I thought about that. And I thought? I'm glad Alex brought it up. My instinct to that when I saw the time and saw that it was confirmed was not that he was actually a 4.75 athlete. I thought he prepared like shit for the combine.
It's just tough, man, because, I mean, and Alex can, attest to this. I mean, when you see, Quinnen Williams run like a 4.83 at 300 pounds, and you see Jordan Humphrey, he attempted to cut weight, and he was almost as near time as an Alabama defensive lineman. It's like, what the hell just happened here? And just to Dallas's point, like, I'm the guy that I always say, no matter what happens in the combine, teams always go back to the film. So, you gotta, it's just one part of the measurement and not the, oh my God, this is it. We're going to throw out everything we saw at the film and just go with the combine stuff. But then you go back to the film and you say, all right, well, he's had 1 year, but he also had 1 year. We didn't have a reception for over 50 yards. And now you have those questions about, can he get space? Can he get separation? And it's just one of those things that the biggest debate catches on our board is, well, what would another year have done for little Jordan Humphrey? Like that becomes the big question that I think there's a lot of, people on different sides of that equation. Obviously if he gets a chance to work on his speed, you get a chance to cut it down. He's not going to be a 4.4 guy, but you get a chance to maybe work on your speed and work on some techniques. And of course, another good year under the belt definitely probably helps. But at the end of the day, the measurements are the measurements, the speed are the speed. So, it's one of those things like, hey, I respect him. You respect him. Hey, this is your dream. You want to play in the NFL? Go for your dream. It's just hard to watch when you're like, ugh, it's that dream is not really working out the way you anticipated that it would.
I don't think he would have improved his speed. I think guys are as fast as they are in terms of like football speed. And then in this time between the end of their senior years or their junior years in this case and the combine and when they test, it's about learning form. It's about, you know, how do you cheat the margins to a certain extent? You know, like I just don't know that little Jordan. I personally, as it projects to, and I'm not saying I'm right because I don't know that I'm right. It's just my opinion. I just, you know, like I think that there's a lot of things that he could have developed in an extra year. I don't know that just in general being a more explosive athlete. What is little Jordan, like 21 years old? So it's like, you know, he 21 to 22 doesn't always translate as much as maybe from 18 to 21 or 15 to 18. I don't know. Like, I think that level of speed, I think he is what he is. If he's going to run a 4.75, it don't matter what year he ever comes out. He can stay for 8 years. If he's going to run a 4.75 and rank in the bottom 25-ish percentile of athletes at his position, NFL teams aren't going to be real interested in that. No matter how many yards he has, no matter how many catches he makes, no matter how many touchdowns he scores, man, 4.75 is like someone farted in the room. Just can't. There's no turning away from it. It's like an emphatic mic drop moment. I didn't realize that.
I mean, it is. I mean, look. I think
we all left. That somebody farted in the room.
I think I put in there, like, you know, in my column. Think, you know, Anquan Boldin ran like I think it was like a 4.71 at his pro day. So I mean, there is hope. Like, and again, these are like, that's like the best case scenario. Like, that is the super best case scenario that you could say, well, Anquan Boldin did it, but that's clearly the anomaly and it's not the norm, because the norm is if you're at that 4.75-ish range or higher, more than likely teams are going to shy away from you.
Oh, no, I clearly, of all the guys that perform at the pro day here, when is that pro day? A couple of weeks?
It's on the 27th.
27th, a couple weeks from now? Yeah. Okay, like 3 weeks away. He will have more, there will be more eyeballs on that, weirdly, his 40 time than I think there will be on anything else. Any other, you got any Kyler Murray thoughts? It literally is, can I say that I, as someone who's not a fan of Kyler Murray, and I will admit, took a couple of shots at him yesterday on where I asked a question of how does a guy lose at the combine in 15-minute interviews, and I was like, he could just be himself. That snide comment aside, I hate this anonymous scout stuff that seems to pop up with some guys more so than others. And it was like right on time. I had a conversation with a buddy of mine a week ago about how long it would take before we started kind of seeing anti-Kyler Murray talking points. And it happened, I think, earlier than we all thought. Because we weren't anticipating just a couple of days, and it turned out to be that way. Anwar, I'll throw it to you. Kyler Murray's not my favorite guy.
Really?
I think he's a shithead. However, dude, if we're talking like in the NFL, there's a lot of the, like, Ben Roethlisberger is a shithead. And
I'm hanging up. See you later.
And he's got Super Bowl rings. And
Antonio Brown would agree with you on that one.
You know what I mean? Like, it doesn't matter that I personally don't like Kyler Murray or that he was late a bunch in high school. Like, it is a sport where divas exist, big personalities exist. I would never suggest that Kyler Murray wasn't an alpha male, right? Like, there are things about his personality that I think are really positive as it relates to him being a professional athlete. I'm just, with your NFL background, and, you know, it's interesting how these stories sometimes pop up, and it's interesting which players sometimes get this scrutiny versus those that don't. And, you know, a day later, I actually feel like the discussion of the last 24 hours with Murray was unfair. Alex, real quick, was there a vibe at the combine? Like, were there whispers about this, or did that come out of nowhere yesterday?
I mean, it never comes out of nowhere whenever Charlie Cassidy uses it. shitty GM and a crotchety old man talk shit about kids. It's like, when are these assholes gonna when are these assholes gonna learn? Like the Greg Gabriels on Twitter and the Charlie Casserleys, and to some degree, like, I mean, I love Phil Savage, but that guy was a failed GM that was super hard and crotchety. Like, Charlie Casserley sucks. It's like, what on earth are we doing listening to this asshole? I'm like, so I mean, and the whole thing about anonymous scouts, I get it. What I get it. Why sometimes people quote anonymous scouts, because here's the fact of the matter. Omar will tell you this. We all know a ton of scouts. I mean, we all know a bunch of scouts. And the one thing that any friend who's a scout will tell you is like, man, you know, I'll tell you this stuff. You can put it, you know, unless I tell you not to put it out there, or that, like, it's going to, you know, if you put it out there, people know exactly where it's coming from. So don't put it out there. But generally, they don't care if you put stuff out there, as long as you don't use their name and you don't name their team and stuff like that. And a lot of the times it's valuable information that you think people would be interested to hear, but it just doesn't. This is never put in the context that it should be. The fact that this is generally, you know, in Casserley's case, maybe a little bit different, but he did say from anonymous scouts, not from anonymous like lead sources or front office folks. It's generally the view of a guy who's not a decision maker, a view of a guy who is supposed to be providing information to the decision makers, but ultimately has no power to make any decisions within the franchise. I mean, hell, half the NFL franchises don't even allow scouts inside the interview rooms at the combine. They don't even allow them.
They're low level employees.
They really are. They're support staff. And so what you think? And also, I mean, even going even further to put this in even more perspective, I mean, almost this is a kind of a dirty little secret of the NFL. Almost anybody with enough elbow grease and knocking on enough doors and just doing just enough networking, almost anybody can be a scout. It's less about what you know and more about, like, all right, are you willing to be on the road 280 days a year, not have a family, and make like 30 grand a year for the first 5 years that you're working for us, then yeah, like, let's see your Excel spreadsheets with your, you know, reviews of these players. And that's just, it's, I'd say that probably the biggest sticking point in finding, you know, guys who are talented scouts is not necessarily finding guys who have the most talent, but just guys who are willing to do the damn job. And so it's like, whenever you hear stuff from scouts, of course you want to put it out there because it is a guy who's on a support staff. He's providing information to the decision makers about what they should do on draft day, how they should view these players, et cetera, et cetera. And I'm not saying that the value is not important and not valuable. For that reason, if somebody tells you something interesting, you want to put it out there. But when you put it out there and it's from these anonymous scouts, it's these sources, the average reader of that tweet or listener to that, you know, bit of, you know, that reader of that headline or listener to that one bit on the NFL Network and stuff doesn't put it in the proper context. And you're just really talking about one or two guys' opinions that really don't mean too much of a hill of beans in this whole thing, except for the fact that you value them because they've been on the road, they've been doing all this work. You know, they certainly always have interesting insight that other people don't have, but it's not like it means shit.
It's just to piggyback off what Alex is saying, because he's 100% spot on. Like, you know, those guys, this is why I, like, you know, always caution when you start hearing, well, these scouts are saying this, and you hear, like, the scouts are saying this guy's a first-round pick in September, right? Again, we're talking about a low-level person who's saying that. Pete Carroll hasn't looked at anybody's film in September. He's focusing on game plans. Jason Garrett, all these guys. Belichick, they're not looking at college film at that point. They start looking at college film when their seasons get over. And that's when they start doing their reviews. And then that's when the real draft board comes in. And so, like, that, to Alex's point, yeah, they get the Excel spreadsheet and they may look at some of the notes and then they toss them to the side. And then these guys make their own opinions because, damn it, they're not going to say, well, this regional scout who was over in Oklahoma saw somebody, or this other person who was in Texas, so they'll tell, thinks Charles Emanuel, he was great. They're going to say, does this guy pass my eye test? And that's why they go to the Senior Bowl, you know, event that Alex goes to, because they want to see these guys, you know, one-on-one, and they're reviewing films. And then, of course, the combine, then they bring these guys in for their own private workouts. And that's how these decisions are made. So anything that's saying a scout says something it literally means nothing, because at the end of the day, you know, Clarence, you know, he'll put out stuff that Arizona is still very interested in him, and so are the Raiders. And, you know, Alex can give you whatever his mock draft is, but I mean, he's a first round pick, you know, at the end of the day. But, you know, of course, there's going to be things against Kyler Murray, just kind of going away from the scouts. I mean, since high school catch, this guy's been the shot caller. He's called the shots. He's been able to do what he wants whenever he wants, and people have all fallen in line. And here he goes. He gets drafted in baseball, and people are going to think, okay, he's just going to bow down and be a baseball guy. He's like, nah, I'm good. I don't need baseball. Screw it. Take it back. I'll do football. So once again, he's doing everything that he wants, and I'm sure there's got to be some part of people are just like resenting that this guy has just been able to do whatever he wants, call his own shots, and still kind of be a little arrogant in the process, which kind of rubs people the wrong way. But at the end of the day, dude, if you're winning and you are a winner, the NFL's going to put up with a lot of stuff, man. And they'll like, I mean, they just kill. A lot. You can kill and still be in the NFL. Like, they will put up with a lot as long as you can win. And what they look at, the last thing I'll say is when you're in the NFL, you have your elite quarterbacks. So you have your Aaron Rodgers of the world, you have your Drew Brees of the world, you have your Tom Brady, and then you can throw in maybe, you know, fourth guy that you might think is elite. You have some guys who are below that who are pretty good, who are not going to be great, like your Matthew Stafford of the world, probably never going to lead you to a Super Bowl, but he's going to be competitive. And then you just got a bunch of guys. You just got a bunch of Jags. Like, everyone else is just a Jag. You know, your Tyrod Taylors of the world, they're just Jags. And so if you don't have one of those elite guys, you're always on the search to try to find someone that's better. Now, if you got somebody that's really good, again, I use Matthew Stafford. He's really good. You'll stay with that, because if you get rid of that, then what's the alternative? But when you're in a lottery, more than likely you don't have somebody that's really good. And if you don't have an elite quarterback, you have no chance of winning, period.
Fellas, can I hop in real quick? I got my son acting like a maniac. I got some goddamn squirrels trying to get on my bird seat. I'll let my anger at the anonymous scouts be my party shot, man.
Fair enough.
I'll just bug out of here and let Dustin talk.
Or Charlie Casserly.
Well, the Casserly thing was my favorite. I'm looking at the clock. Let's just go into party shots as to not turn this into a marathon session. Plus, our producer does need to get out of his house for South by Southwest reasons. Anwar, you got a parting shot?
Nope.
You got lots of shots in, so perfectly fine. What about you, Dustin? You want to talk about this freaking baseball team in your parting shot?
I mean, they raised the bar with that sweep of LSU, and I admit I was cautious with them going into the season just because they lost so many pieces. Lose Cody Clemens, you lose David Hamilton before the year, you lose a lot of experience, but I was always high on the pitching staff stuff. I mean, that's one thing you can show up and you can see. You know, it becomes a matter of strike throwing and executing those things, which we've seen, you know, in a couple games. With their Sunday game at Louisiana and the UTSA's surprising loss on Wednesday, they had 19 walks in that game, which at one point, before the LSU series, was over half of their walks for the season. So they're going to have those clunkers at times, but man, they raised the bar in terms of what they're capable of doing by sweeping LSU. And I thought it was, and I wrote about this and I've done a podcast about it. It was just a complete, you know, the Friday and Saturday games, they completely outplayed LSU. The Sunday game, they tried to hand LSU that game, and they've done this all year. They have a great, they've got really good makeup amongst that team, and they compete, man. They really are not out of the game until the final out of the game, and that's what we saw against LSU. I mean, it's 40 degrees. The guy on the mound is, you know, 6'5", throwing 97 with an 88-mile-an-hour slider. It would have been easy for those guys to check out, be like, all right, we got a series win over the number two team in the country. That's pretty good. You know, we can pack it in and be done. There weren't many people in the seats, although they created good energy considering the conditions. And they just competed. They just made things happen. They just refused to strike out, put the ball in play, forced LSU to make plays, and Austin Todd has a big hit. So I think that now you've got to say that they're capable of having the season they had last year. I think that when you look at the landscape of the Big 12, Baylor's had some really enormous injury issues. I mean, Kendall Rogers just reported yesterday that Cody Bradford is out for the year, the reigning Big 12 pitcher of the year. He had to get thoracic outlet syndrome, so that's a huge blow. Shea Langlier broke his hammy. I mean, he's probably going to be a first-round pick at catcher. So now you got to knock down Baylor a couple pegs. Texas Tech hasn't been that great to start the year. TCU's kind of been a little up and down. You can kind of look at this Texas team and say, you know, why couldn't they win the Big 12 again? You know, with the way they're playing after the sweep of LSU and the way they've started the season. So it's, I think the one thing Texas fans should appreciate most about what happened against LSU is the Texas coaching staff ran circles around LSU. LSU did not look prepared. They didn't scout Texas well. Their pitchers are really slow to the plate, and Texas just kept running on them over and over and over again. And the one time that LSU pitched out, Texas didn't steal. They were putting hit and runs on, double steals. They were bunting. Their pitch sequences were better. Their pitcher usage was better. Their personnel decisions were better. They were tougher. They were more competitive. I mean, it was a complete dominant effort on Friday and Saturday. And then on Sunday, you saw the competitiveness. And I think tip your hat to David Pearson and his guys. They proved to be the far superior coaching staff that series against LSU. I mean, Paul Maneri, after Bryce Elder pitched, was like, oh, we were expecting him to throw 75% sinkers. I mean, you can watch Bryce Elder throw for an inning and know that he's going to throw a lot of cutters to both right-handers and left-handers. And then after the game, he's like, oh, he threw 75% cutters, when in reality, he threw 40%. To me, that's kind of a doofus quote from a coach. I'm not the biggest Paul Maneri fan because he keeps telling people that Texas offered him the job when, in fact, didn't do it. I'll stop there from going on a rant. But, yeah, this Texas baseball team has raised the bar, and I think Texas fans should be excited not only about the potential of this team, with the understanding of you still got to go play four games at number six Stanford, and then you got to play a top 10-type Texas Tech team, and then you got to play on the road at TCU, who's the top 25 team. So the schedule doesn't let up for a long time, definitely throughout the entire month of March, double midweek against Arkansas as well. But they're capable of having the season they had last season. And also, if you look at the potential of this pitching staff now and long term, there are a lot of freshmen and redshirt freshmen and sophomores that are really, really throwing the baseball well. And those guys are going to be in the program for at least another year. So the future long term looks bright as well.
I think what it does, you know, there'll be a lot. They could get swept against Stanford this weekend, and it could be all close games. And sometimes you have a bad weekend, right? I mean, I've seen national championship level Longhorn teams go to Manhattan and get swept, and it doesn't make any sense. But those teams could always draw on previous experiences to let them know that, like, it'll be okay. And I think they get a get out of jail card. Like, if they have a bad weekend the rest of the season, or two bad weekends, they know what is possible when they do play well. So it's a matter of being able to channel what they were able to do this weekend. Like, now do it again. The more you do it, the better you'll be. But this team has a level that when they hit it, they can beat almost anybody. And I think they learned that this weekend. That was my read on everything that happened. Is like, there's now going to be a self-belief in this group of guys that they can do anything, despite not having their best hitters or the top two hitters from the fall, that kind of thing.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's especially important with so many young guys or inexperienced guys that are really being contributors at Texas for the first time. I mean, that's pretty much almost the entire pitching staff besides Blair Henley. In a lot of, you know, position players that are young that are playing a lot as well. Now you lose DJ Petrinski for the year, and you got to hope Michael McCann can stay healthy behind the plate. But yeah, just the self-belief, you know, it's one thing to think you can do it. It's another thing if you do it. And I think that Sunday win especially was big. Because they could have just packed it in, and instead they found a way to win. I think it says a lot about their character. If they compete like that consistently and they have that sort of belief, and then you throw in the fact that this coaching staff through the first two seasons has done a really good job of maximizing what it has, you can, you know, if they go to Stanford and drop 3 out of 4 at the number 6 team in the country, but they're competitive and they don't play terribly, you can, okay, we've got some confidence that over the long haul of this season, they're going to get the most out of this group, and this group is going to compete on a consistent basis, and they're going to have the belief that they can play well. So, yeah, those things were very important. And yeah, if they were to, you know, only win one against LSU or get swept by LSU, then you're going on the road at Stanford thinking, okay, like we're playing another top 10 team. We haven't proven we can beat these kind of guys. You know, what happens there if you lose 3 out of 4 there and suddenly the season kind of hits a low point. But yeah, that LSU sweep was especially big. And I know that, you know, David Pierce before that said, I know we have the character. I know we have, you know, the competitiveness. I want to see if we have the talent and can that talent show. Well, it showed against one of the better teams in the country.
Yeah, no reason for there to be any doubt in that group. Jason, any parting shots you want to sneak in?
Short and sweet. Texas will have 2 unofficial visitors this weekend. Fort Bend Austin wide receiver Troy O'Meara will be in, and Cy Creek linebacker Josh White, both unofficial visits, coming in with their trainer. I posted a Josh White interview or story actually while we were recording this podcast.
You interviewed him, wrote it?
Well, no, I didn't interview him. I interviewed him last night, but I did write it while we were dabbling in this podcast a little bit. Thank you, mute button. And I even executed the mute button flawlessly. Thank you. But Josh White is an interesting guy.
Moment of silence for us being able to pull that off. No, go ahead.
I think the last few weeks we've been flawless there. We're finally figuring it out. But he's an interesting guy to follow. He was committed to Oklahoma State, Texas. He's always really liked Texas. Well, Texas just offered him about a week and a half ago. He's visiting this weekend. I talked to him last night. Listen, I'm not expecting him to commit, but it won't be completely out of the question if he just falls in love this weekend either. So we'll be keeping an eye on both of those visits on Saturday.
I don't really have a parting shot either. I was going to give Dustin the Dustin felt seconds away, like from being on a Alex level rant on the LSU baseball coach. And there was a part of me that wanted to poke and prod him a little bit and see if, like, there was a Paul Mariner rant that would warrant a goddamn cockamamie. Dustin, do you got one of them in you, or you want to just let that one lie?
Well, it's, you know, of course, like before every series, you know, what's the beat writer going to do that covers LSU? Well, you know, LSU is going to go play at Texas. Well, you're going to ask Paul Mariner about, you know, Texas, trying to get you to be their coach, and what would it be like if you were the coach, and so on and so forth. I mean, it's the kind of content that you'd expect, you know, the days heading into that series. But it just pisses me off that this guy keeps telling people that Texas offered him the job, and that just didn't happen. Like, he called Texas out there, and of course, if an LSU's head coach has won a national title, calls you up when you have a head coaching opening and says, hey, come out and see me, I'm interested, well, you've got to at least go out there and see the guy. So Texas does that, but they sniff it out. They figure he's not, you know, seriously interested. They never talk job offer. They never talk parameters or anything like that. And what comes out predictably the very next morning after Texas flies out there, you've got some story in the Baton Rouge Advocate or whatever saying that, oh, you know, Texas offered him the job and now he's going to go, what's the AD going to do? No, Paul Mariner just took Texas flying out there and then went up to his dumb athletic director. The guy has a reputation for being an idiot. And it's like, hey, look, Texas is offering me this job. You've got to give me a raise. And, of course, he falls for it and immediately ends up giving him a raise out of it, where Paul Mariner never was offered the job. Texas never really had enough interest to offer them the job because they figured out once they got out there that he was just using it to get a pat on the back and a raise. I mean, the guy is known for being somebody that just needs his ego stroked all the time and needs to be encouraged and propped up, even though he's a freaking LSU baseball coach. And you know what? You saw that from his team against Texas. They weren't as competitive. They weren't as tough. They weren't as well coached. You know, maybe if Paul Mariner would spend more time scouting a pitcher that throws cutters and know he's going to throw cutters instead of telling people he got offered the Texas head coaching job, which never happened, maybe his team would have played a little bit better. But no, he's got this inferiority complex despite the fact that he's LSU's head coach. And it pisses me off when guys – just try to change the truth about something. Just say that Texas came out and they talked to you and you had some interest and there was never an offer. You still want to get a freaking raise over it. But no, I saw that coming from a mile away when Texas went out there. I was like, I know this guy's reputation. I know he's getting a little heated at LSU. He just wants his ego stroked. He wants somebody to tell him he's a good guy and that they want him and things like that, and he wants some more money. And that's exactly what happened, but Texas never offered him the job. So it just – it's pissed me off when I saw those stories before the LSU series. Like, oh, what if – you know, when Texas offered Paul Maneri the job and all these players call him and say, Coach, don't go. And, you know, what would have life been like if he took the job and blah, 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 blah. Well, you just got swept. So turn around and go home. The program that never offered the job just swept you. And the coach that they hired out-coached you for three games.
Nobody pokes the hornet's nest better than I do. MB Horns and Anwar's Fedora add Paul Maneri to the triggered list.
He does trigger me, man.
I think we have to add the LSU baseball coach to the triggered list. Real quick, one, Anwar. I want to trigger you just a bit, too. I thought it was funny. It's so weird how I think sometimes people laugh and think I'm lying when I say I'm a bit gun-shy about the – I sold some football cards on the website the other day. And I really asked for permission to do so on my own website because I was afraid that I would get beaten up over it, because we get beat up over little things all the time. And sometimes you just don't want to deal with the hassle. The you shouldn't use the word nugget.
Oh, my God. I was just looking at this again.
I saw the back end of the thread. For those that don't know, Anwar posted some – I'm sure most of you have seen it – Wednesday Night Nugget. And the nugget was that they moved one guy back, Rob Cummins, back over from offense
from
to defense.
From tight end to defense.
Yeah. But the real news, which I think people were not given enough credit, was that there weren't any others. That this guy is it. So while he might not be notable, the overall information that nobody else at this point, they're planning to move, I thought that was the real nugget, that – that people took exception to the word nugget for multiple reasons. They were upset that Chip Brown, once upon a time, used the word nuggets. So, of course, you're stealing verbiage from Chip.
It's unreal.
There are people who said you use too much hyperbole in using the word nugget, which you properly pointed out. You know that a nugget is small.
I mean, nuggets, there's a difference between nugget and steak, right? And it wasn't like huge bombshell news. We have the most thankless job, right? Because maybe garbage men have the most thankless job, right? But we have just a thankless job. Like, it is thankless.
I wave at my garbage guys, man. I wave for them and smile. I don't even think we get that sometimes.
No, man. It is an amazing. Okay, all right. You want to trigger me? Here we go. So it's amazing that someone could have something on another site, right? And here it is. TOS is reporting mods, !! Right? And then all of a sudden, so we're like, it's like, what's going on? And we get tagged. I'm tagged in this. What's going on? I don't know. All this type of shit, right? And so but when we post something, it's like a golf clap. Like, no one gives a damn. Like, no one cares. It's just, they just expect it. And it's just like, that's just what should happen. And this is what you should do. It's to the point where if that had little nugget, crumb, whatever you want to call it, right? If it had been on another website, we would have had like three threads on our website, because people expect us to have the information. But when we have the information, because they have that expectation that we're always going to have things first, when we do have it, it's like you don't even appreciate what you have. You don't even appreciate what you're paying for and the things that you're getting and the hard work that goes into getting that type of stuff, even if you want to call it a nugget. But then they just want to bitch about it. And it's like, why do you call it a nugget? Like, you're it's too much. Like, I said it was a nugget. It's a little nugget. It's a little. It takes two bites to finish them, maybe one.
You didn't call it a tender. You called it a nugget.
And it's just, why are you using the word nuggets? I'm like, I'll do better when I'm giving you all the inside information that you want, when you know the ins and outs from little to big about the team. I'll do better on my end to not use the word nugget in a headline, because that's all you can bitch about. Like, if that's all you are bitching about, really, like, it annoys me.
Did you just throw something?
Yes. Yes.
You ain't triggering me today, Catch. Don't even try.
I know. I just have to say that Athens Lawyer, shout out, 2008 sign-up. He's a 10-year member. He's got seniority on some level. He used the word nugget in quotes. And he wrote, nugget is a big-time stretch. And I'm like, God, no! There's no hyperbole! He didn't hype it. He didn't do anything. He called it a nugget singular. And, when I went through the second page, because I read the first page yesterday, Anwar, and I was like, okay, people got some smart-ass comments, whatever. But I didn't realize until in the middle of this podcast when I clicked on the second page that it had literally turned into, like, a stream of contents of people discussing the virtue of you using the word nugget.
It's just amazing. It's just amazing. Like, to understand, like, how hard it is to develop, sources where you feel like you can lean on them and they can trust you with information, and then you're passing that along to your readers. You're like, here you guys go. Here's a little nugget. Just a little nugget for you. You're like, nugget? Oh, you're piping this up. No, if I say you come to my house because we're having nuggets, all right, it means we're going to have nuggets. It's like, well, you hyped it up. I'm like, no. If I said, hey, come because it's going to be Cinco de Mayo and we got all types of, like, chips and dip and we got some drinks and all, like, that's hyping it up. And then I gave you a nugget. But I told you it's a nugget. Do you know what a nugget is? A nugget small. It's a really small thing. It's and yes, Rob Cummings, with some of the third was like, his name is Max. What are you talking about? Rob. His name is Max. And other people have to check these people. Like, no, his name is Rob. He's been Rob since he stepped on campus. I was like, this is just such a little bit, like, the bitching of stuff. I'm not saying, hey, everyone just bow down and be appreciative because you're in the presence of greatness. Damn. Like, what are you complaining about right now when you're getting inside info and you're complaining because of the word nugget?
I've got tears in my eyes. For myself and Anwar and Dustin, who were both triggered, for Alex, who was surprisingly not, and for Jason, who, we'll find out what happens with the house closing soon, and maybe next week he'll be triggered. And for myself, thank you for listening. We went a little long today, but I enjoyed it. We'll talk to you next week. Later.